What is it to carry yourself in a way that is challenging to authority, that is taking you outside of complacency and co-optation and cooperating with authorities and unjust realities, and challenging and putting yourself in a dangerous space in order to accomplish a journey towards the truth? So I can talk about it in a lot of different ways, but you don't really understand it in an authentically indigenous way or in our culture unless you understand it in the context of the languages and the ideas and the philosophies and values that come from our culture. And I think that any scholar, indigenous scholar, needs to start from her own and his own cultural rootedness in order to have anything authentic to say to other indigenous people. And so for me, another step in that journey was talking to my own people, like Michael, who know and who have spent their lives thinking about these things in the context of our language and culture, to get a rootedness in the ideas, and to base my critique or my analysis or my ideas on a solid foundation. And so that's essentially what this book is about, is to try to understand from the context of our own culture, language, history, what it is to be a warrior, what it is to be authentically indigenous today, when, in essence, colonialism has morphed from a physical process of dispossession, of imposition of authorities through military force and so forth, to something that is more identifiable as a process of mind transformation or soul transformation than anything else. And so the struggle has changed. I'm not saying that the struggle over land and jurisdiction and nationhood and all those things has gone away or evaporated, or that they're not threats anymore. But what I'm saying, and what I've come to understand in talking to people and traveling all over North America and interacting with people involved in different indigenous struggles, and talking to scholars and teachers and mothers and all kinds of people who are involved in trying to, in various ways, live an indigenous life, is that the struggle so today is really one of trying to resist against the overwhelming cultural and spiritual force of Western life and Western capitalism and Western values. And that it manifests itself in ways that are very identifiable as colonial, in the sense that in the British Columbia, there's the British Columbia Treaty process, which is still a process of gaining ownership of indigenous lands against their consent or through co-optive means. that's still something that's there. Colonialism is alive and well in that kind of process of dispossession. Colonialism is there as the Mohawk people and the Iroquois people and the Mi'kmaq people and the Cree people are denied their full expression of their right of self-determination in government. Our nationhood is not respected or recognized. That's a colonial process. These things are very identifiable, and they have been consistent over time. And to a large extent, what I'm saying in this book is that we haven't paid enough attention to the fact that colonialism is also very responsive and adaptive, and that imperialism is not just dispossession and not just imposition of law unjustly on indigenous peoples. That colonialism is also this process of the way one thinks and the beliefs and the attitudes and the behaviors that one is molded into culturally, spiritually, and through other different processes within this colonial relationship. And that, in fact, if you just focus on land, say, land claims, self-government struggles, these big processes of what we call decolonization, we're setting ourselves up for failure. Because whether or not we want to acknowledge it, colonialism has worked its way into the way that we think that we live and that we are. So being indigenous today, in fact, is the struggle. It's the objective. It's no longer a situation where we can count on, I believe, maybe with a generation or two ago with our elders, people who can go forward and engage the state on land and government issues from a very solid foundation in the culture, and say that, almost take it for granted, 2-3 generations ago that the people who were going and representing our people had knowledge of the language, had knowledge and were connected to and accountable to communities and cultures to the extent, and I realize this is not the case purely at any one time, there's always exceptions, there's always problems and so forth, but the cultural foundation that our people were standing on in engaging the state on land and governance issues was so broad and so deep that that type of engagement was something that could be justified in terms of making compromises in the type that politics demands. If you're going to go and engage someone in a British Columbia land process, and it's a political process, there's going to be give and take. That's what politics is. And so to give and take 3 generations ago, when you're standing on a foundation of 100% linguistic fluency in your indigenous language, all the ceremonial knowledge, all the cultural knowledge being carried by that community, a little give and take is maybe justifiable in the context of that situation. You could rationalize it at least. Maybe I don't want to say justifiable because in hindsight we know the effects of it, and I don't want to excuse that. But at that time and place, that person coming into that situation could say, look at our community, and look how solid we are, look how unified we are. Giving a little bit in terms of land and governance powers in exchange for peace and prosperity, we can do that. And in fact, that's what all Native communities did. There were some instances where it was coerced, where it was forced on them, but for the most part, people made that calculation in their mind, and they accepted the Indian Act. They accepted land deals, they accepted all these types of things. And who are we, 100 years later, to criticize them for what they did? We weren't there, we don't know. We know the effects, though. And one of those effects is that, whether it's attributable directly to that process of cooperation with the state and so forth, or whether it's just attributable to other kinds of social and cultural changes in the world that resulted in the life that we live now, the fact is that that cultural foundation that we once stood on is something, if it was this big before, it's this big now. You talk about the language loss, you look at the loss of knowledge of our history, of the values and the principles and the whole idea and set of behaviors and ways of thinking and believing that made up what it was to be Ungwenhoe 100 years ago. And you look at that today, and we're standing on a very slim margin of existence. And it seems like we're almost on a precipice where any little bit of loss is going to lead to, in the end, almost the extinguishment of our existence as indigenous people. It's that precarious. There's a lot of nations where there's 1 speaker left, 3 speakers left, nobody who knows the stories and so forth, and it's that precarious in existence. And now, if you think about that reality, to go and engage the state in a political process that inherently involves compromise because it's politics, I think it's a different calculation now than 100 years ago. When any degree of compromise results in an incremental effect a relative effect that is so much more damaging than 100 years ago. But we don't acknowledge that when we go and we engage in these processes. We still have the rhetoric in indigenous politics of nationhood. We have the rhetoric of being rooted in history and of a political perspective that is, for example, Iroquois or Cree or so forth, when in fact, there's been a lot of damage in our communities and a lot of loss in our communities that results in leadership interacting on land and governance issues from a very, very weakened cultural understanding.